in this fool's nightshirt, holding the leash on a goat. He vowed he would steal a Xaele and cut a Spartan's throat one day. I told him he must not speak like this in my hearing. What'll you do, report me? I wouldn't, and he knew it. But by the gods, I swore to him, raise your hand once against them, any one of them, and I'll kill you. Rooster laughed. Pluck a sharp stick from the roadside and drive it into your sockets, my friend. It couldn't make you any blinder than you are already. The army reached the frontier at Oeon at nightfall of the second day, and Sparta herself 12 hours later. Runners had preceded the troops. The city had known for 2 days the identities of the wounded and the slain. Funeral games stood already in preparation. They would be celebrated within the fortnight. That evening and the following day were consumed in decamping the battle train, cleaning and refitting weapons and armor, reshafting spears which had been shivered in combat, and rewriting the oaken hubs of the Hoplon shields, disassembling and storing the riggings of the wagons, tending to the pack and draft animals, making sure each beast was properly watered and groomed and dispersed with their helot teamsters to their various clairoi, the farmsteads they worked. That second night the peers of the train at last returned to their messes. This was customarily a solemn evening in the aftermath of a battle, when fallen comrades were memorialized, acts of valor recognized and dishonorable conduct censured, when errors were reviewed and turned to instruction, and the grave capital of battle stored up against future need. The messes of the peers are customarily havens of respite and confidentiality, sanctuaries within which all converse is privileged and private. Here, after the long day, friends may let down their hair among friends, speak as gentlemen the truths of their hearts, and even, though never to excess, embrace the mellowing comfort of a bowl or two of wine. This night, however, was not one for ease or conviviality. The souls of the 28 perished hung heavily over the city. The secret shame of the warrior, the knowledge within his own heart that he could have done better, done it more swiftly or with less self-preserving hesitation, this censure, always most pitiless when directed against oneself, gnawed unspoken and unrelieved at the men's guts. No decoration or prize of valor, not victory itself, could quell it entire. "Well," Polyneikes called the youth Alexandros forward and addressed him sternly, "how did you like it?" He meant war. To be there, to see it raw and entire. The evening stood now well advanced. The hour of the epikla had expired, that second course of the meal at which game meat and wheaten bread may be contributed, and now the 16 peers of the Deucalion mess settled, hunger satisfied, upon their hardwood couches. Now the lads who stood to the mess for their instruction might be summoned and roasted upon the griddle. Alexandros was made to stand forth before his elders at the position of boy's attention, hands tucked from sight beneath the folds of his cloak, eyes glued to the floor as not yet worthy of rising to meet a peer's full in the face. "How did you enjoy the battle?" Polyneikes queried. "It made me sick," Alexandros replied. Under the interrogation, the boy confessed that he had been unable to sleep since, neither aboard ship nor on the march home. If he closed his eyes, even for a moment, he declared, he saw again with undiminished horror the scenes of slaughter, particularly the death spasm of his friend Meriones. His compassion, he acknowledged, was elicited as much by those casualties of the enemy as for the fallen heroes of his own city. Pressed hard upon this point, the boy declared the slaughter of war barbarous and unholy. "Barbarous and unholy, is it?" responded Polyneikes, darkening with anger. "The peers in their messes are encouraged, when they deem it useful for the instruction of youth, to single out one lad or even another peer, and abuse him verbally in the most stern and pitiless fashion. This is called arosis, harrowing. Its purpose much like the physical beatings, is to inure the senses to insult, to harden the will against responding with rage and fear, the twin unmanning evils of which that state called catalepsis, possession, is comprised. The prized response, the one the peers look for, is humor. Deflect defamation with a joke. The coarser the better. Laugh in its face. A mind which can maintain its lightness will not come undone in war. But Alexandras possessed no gift for the wisecrack. It wasn't in him. All he could do was answer in his clear, pure voice with the most excruciating candor. I watched him from my service station at the left of the mess entrance, beneath the carven plaque, Exo tes theras uden, out this door nothing, meaning no word spoken within these precincts may be repeated elsewhere. It was a form of high courage which Alexandras displayed to stand up to the peers hammering without a joke or a lie. At any time during a harrowing, the object boy may signal and call a stop. This is his right, under the laws of Lycurgus. Pride, however, prevented Alexandras from exercising this option, and everyone knew it. "You wanted to see war," Polyneikes began. "What did you imagine it would be?" Alexandras was required to answer in the Spartan style, at once with extreme brevity. "Your eyes were horror-stricken. Your heart aggrieved at the sight of the manslaughter. Answer this. What did you think a spear was for? A shield? A Xiphos sword?" Questions of this kind would be put to the boy not in a harsh or abusive tone, which would have been easier to bear, but coldly, rationally, demanding a concisely expressed, reasoned response. Alexandras was made to describe the wounds an eight-footer could produce and the types of deaths that would ensue. Should an overhand thrust be aimed at the throat or the chest? If the tendon of a foeman's calf be severed, should you pause to finish him off or press forward with the advance? If you plunge a spear into the groin, above a man's testicles, should it be pulled straight out or ripped upward, blade vertical, to eviscerate the man's bowels? Alexandros's face flushed, his voice quaked and broke. "Would you like to stop, boy? Is this instruction too much for you? Answer concisely. Can you envision a world without war? Can you imagine clemency from an enemy? Describe the condition of Lacedaemon without her army, without her warriors to defend her. Which is better, victory or defeat? To rule or be ruled? To make a widow of the enemy's wife, or to have one's own wife widowed? What is the supreme virtue of a man? Why? Whom of all in the city do you admire most? Why? Define the word mercy. Define compassion. Are these the virtues of war or of peace? Of men or of women? Are they virtues at all?" Of the peers who harrowed Alexandras this evening, Polyneikes did not on the surface seem the most relentless or display the harshest severity. He did not lead the arosis, nor was his interrogation overtly cruel or malicious. He just wouldn't let it stop. In the tone of the other men's voices, no matter how ruthlessly they grilled Alexandras, resided at bottom the unspoken fundament of inclusion. Alexandras was of their blood. He was one of them. Everything they did tonight and every other night was not to break his spirit or crush him like a slave, but to make him stronger, to temper his will and render him more worthy of being called warrior, as they were of taking his place as a Spartiate and a peer. Polyneikes's harrowing was different. There was something personal about it. He hated the boy, though it was impossible to guess why. What made it even more painful, to watch as it must have been to endure, was Polyneikes's supreme physical beauty. in every aspect of his person, face as well as physique. The knight was formed as flawlessly as a god. Naked in the gymnasium, even alongside scores of youths and warriors blessed in comeliness and elevated by their training to the peak of condition, Polyneikes stood out without equal, surpassing all others in symmetry of form and faultlessness of physical structure. Clothed in white robes for the assembly, he shone like Adonis. And, armed for war, with the bronze of his shield burnished, his scarlet cloak across his shoulders and the horsehair-crested helmet of a knight pushed back upon his brow, he shone forth peerless as Achilles. To watch Polyneikes train on the big ring in preparation for the games at Olympia or Delphi or Nemea, to behold him in the pastel light of day's end, when he and the other sprinters had finished their distance work and now, under the eyes of their trainers, donned their racing armor for the final dressed sprints, even the most hardened peers, training in the boxing oval or the wrestling pits, would pull up from their regiments and watch. Four runners regularly trained with Polyneikes. Two brothers, Malaneus and Gorgone, both victors at Nemea in the Diaulos sprint, Dorion the knight who could outrun a racehorse over 60 meters, and Telamonius the boxer, and Inamatarch of the Wild Olive Regiment. The five would take their marks, and a trainer would clap the start. For 30 meters, sometimes as long as 50, the elite field remained a pack of straining bronze and flesh, laboring beneath the weight of their harness, and for a span of heartbeats the watching peers would think, maybe this once, maybe this singular time, one will best him. Then from the fore, as the runners' accelerating power began to break the bonds of their burdens, Polyneikes' churning shield would emerge, 20 pounds of oak and bronze sustained upon the pumping flesh and sinew of his left forearm. You saw his helmet flash, his polished greaves extended next, flying like the winged sandals of Hermes himself. And then, with a force and power so magnificent they stopped the heart, Polyneikes would catapult out of the pack, blazing with such impossible swiftness that he seemed to be naked, even winged, and not belabored by the poundage upon his arm and across his back. Around the turning pole he flew. Daylight burst between him and his pursuers. He vaulted forward to the finish, 400 meters total, no longer in his mind competing with these lesser fellows, these pedestrian mortals, any one of whom in another city would have been the object of adoration, mobbed by throngs of admirers, but who here, against this invincible runner, were doomed to eat dust and like it. This was Polyneikes. No one could touch him. He possessed in every pore those blessings of feature and physique which the gods allow to combine in a single mortal only once in a generation. Alexandros was beautiful, too. Even with the broken nose Polyneikes had gifted him with, his physical perfection approached that of the peerless runner. Perhaps this in some way lay at the root of the hatred the man felt for the boy, that he, Alexandros, whose joy lay in the chorus and not on the athletic field, was unworthy of this gift of beauty, that it in him failed to reflect the manly virtue, the Andrea, which it in Polyneikes so infallibly proclaimed. My own suspicion was that the runner's animus was inflamed further by the favor Alexandros had found in Dionyces' eyes. For of all the men in the city with whom Polyneikes competed in virtue and excellence, he resented most my master. Not so much for the honors Dionyces had been granted by his peers in battle, for Polyneikes, like my master, had been awarded the prize of valor twice, and he was 10 or 12 years younger. It was something else, some less obvious aspect of character which Dionyces possessed and which the city honored him by recognizing instinctively without prompting or ceremony. Polyneikes saw it in the way the young boys and girls joked with Dionyces when he passed their Spheropaedia, the ball-playing fields, during the noonday break. He caught it in the tilt of a smile from a matron and her maids at the springs, or an old woman passing in the square. Even the helots granted my master a fondness and respect that were withheld from Polynices for all the heaps of honors that were his in other quarters. It galled him, mystified him. He, Polynices, had even produced 2 sons, while Dionyces's issue were all female, 4 daughters who, unless Arete could produce a son, would extinguish his line altogether, while Polynices's strapping, swift lads would one day be warriors and men. That Dionyces wore the respect of the city so lightly and with such self-effacing wit was even more bitter to Polynices. For the runner saw in Dionyces neither beauty of form nor fleetness of foot. Instead he perceived a quality of mind, a power of self-possession which he himself, for all the gifts the gods had lavished upon him, could not call his own. Polynices's courage was that of a lion or an eagle, something in the blood and the marrow which summoned itself out of its own preeminence without thought and gloried in its instinctual supremacy. Dionyces's courage was different. His was the virtue of a man, a fallible mortal, who brought valor forth out of the understanding of his heart, by the force of some inner integrity which was unknown to Polynices. Was this why he hated Alexandros? Was it why he had splintered the boy's nose that evening of the 8-nighter? Polynices sought to break more than the youth's face now. Here, in the mess, he wanted to crack him, to see him come apart. "You look unhappy, Pais, as if the prospect of battle held for you no promise of joy." Polynices ordered Alexandros to recite the pleasures of war, to which the boy responded by rote, citing the satisfactions of shared hardship, of triumph over adversity, of camaraderie and Philadelphia, love of one's comrades in arms. Polynices frowned. "Do you feel pleasure when you sing, boy?"
"Yes, lord."
"And when you flirt around with that trollop Agathe?"
"Yes, lord."
"Then imagine the pleasure that awaits you when you clash in line of battle, shield to shield, with an enemy burning to kill you, and you instead slay him. Can you imagine that ecstasy, you little shitworm?"
"The Pais is trying, lord."
"Let me assist you. Close your eyes and picture it. Obey me."
Polynices was keenly aware of the torment this was causing Dionyces, who held himself controlled and impassive upon his bare couch, just 2 places down.
To plunge a spear blade deep into a man's guts is like fucking, only better. You like to fuck, don't you?"
"The boy doesn't know, lord."
"Don't toy with me, you twittering sparrow!"
Alexandros, on his feet for an hour by this time, had steeled himself utterly. He answered his tormentor's questions, frozen at attention, eyes riveted to the dirt, ready in his guts to endure anything.
"Killing a man is like fucking, boy, only instead of giving life, you take it. You experience the ecstasy of penetration as your warhead enters the enemy's belly and the shaft follows. You see the whites of his eyes roll inside the sockets of his helmet. You feel his knees give way beneath him and the weight of his faltering flesh draw down the point of your spear. Are you picturing this?"
"Yes, lord."
"Is your dick hard yet?"
"No, lord."
"What? You've got your spear in a man's guts and your dog isn't stiff? What are you, a woman?"
At this point the peers of the mess began rapping their knuckles upon the hardwood, an indication that Polynices's instruction was going too far. The runner ignored this.
"Now picture with me, boy. You feel the foe's beating heart upon your iron, and you rip it forth, twisting as you pull. A sensation of joy surges up the ash of your spear, through your hand, and along your arm up into your heart. Are you enjoying this yet?"
"No, lord." You feel like God at that moment, exercising the right only he and the warrior in combat may experience, that of dealing death, of loosing another man's soul and sending it down to hell. You want to savor it, to twist the blade deeper and pull the man's heart and guts out upon the iron point of your spear, but you can't. Tell me why.
Because I must move on and slay the next man.
Are you going to weep now?
No, Lord.
What will you do when the Persians come?
Slay them, Lord.
What if you stand on my right in line of battle? Will your shield protect me?
Yes, Lord.
What if I advance, defended by the shadow of your shield? Will you hold it high at port before me?
Yes, Lord.
Will you bring down your man?
I will.
And the next?
Yes.
I don't believe you. At this the peers rapped more vigorously with their knuckles upon the tables. Deianakes spoke.
This is no longer instruction, Polynices. This is malice.
Is it?
The runner answered, not deigning to look in the direction of his rival.
We'll inquire of its object. Have you had enough, you psalm-singing wad of shit?
No, Lord. The boy begs the peer to continue.
Deianakes stepped in. Gently, with compassion, he addressed the youth, his protege. Why do you tell the truth, Alexandros? You could lie like every other boy and swear you reveled in the witnessing of slaughter. You savored the sight of limbs cleaved and men maimed and murdered within the jaws of war.
I thought of that, Lord. But the company would see through me.
You're fucking right we would,
confirmed Polynices. He heard the anger in his own voice and brought it swiftly under control.
However, out of deference to my esteemed comrade...
Here he turned with a mock courteous bow to Deianakes.
I will address my next question not to this child, but to the mess as a whole.
He paused, then indicated the boy at attention before them.
Who will stand with this woman on his right in the line of battle?
I will,
Deianakes answered without hesitation. Polynices snorted.
Your mentor seeks to shield you, Pydarion. In the pride of his own prowess, he imagines he may fight for two. This is recklessness. The city cannot risk his loss because he has eyes for the comeliness of your girlish face. Enough, my friend.
This from Medon, senior of the mess. The peers seconded with a chorus of knuckle-raps. Polynices smiled.
I accede to your chastisement, gentlemen and elders. Please excuse my excess of zeal. I seek only to impart to our youthful comrade some insight into the nature of reality, the state of man as the gods have made him. May I conclude his instruction? With brevity,
Medon admonished. Polynices turned again to Alexandros. When he resumed now, his voice was gentle and without malice. If anything, it seemed informed with something not unlike kindness and even, odd as it sounds, sorrow.
Mankind, as it is constituted, Polynices said, is a boil and a canker. Observe the specimens in any nation other than Lacedaemon. Man is weak, greedy, craven, lustful, prey to every species of vice and depravity. He will lie, steal, cheat, murder, melt down the very statues of the gods and coin their gold as money for whores. This is man. This is his nature, as all the poets attest. Fortunately, God in his mercy has provided a counterpoise to our species' innate depravity. That gift, my young friend, is war. War, not peace, produces virtue. War, not peace, purges vice. War and preparation for war call forth all that is noble and honorable in a man. It unites him with his brothers and binds them in selfless love, eradicating in the crucible of necessity all which is base and ignoble. There, in the holy mill of murder, the meanest of men may seek and find that part of himself concealed beneath the corrupt, which shines forth brilliant and virtuous, worthy of honor before the gods. Do not despise war, my young friend, nor delude yourself that mercy and compassion are virtues superior to Andrea, to manly valor. He finished, turning to Medon and the elders. Forgive me for waxing long-winded. The harrowing ended. The peers dispersed. Outside, beneath the oaks, Deianakes sought out Polyneikes, addressing him by his praise name, Callistus, which may be defined as harmoniously beautiful or of perfect symmetry. Though in the tone Deianakes employed, it expressed itself in the converse as pretty boy or angel face. Why do you hate this youth so much? Deianakes demanded. The runner replied without hesitation. Because he does not love glory. And is love of glory the supreme virtue of a man? Of a warrior? And of a racehorse and a hunting dog? It is the virtue of the gods which they command us to emulate. The others of the mess could overhear this exchange, though they affected not to, since under the laws of Lycurgus, no matter discussed behind those doors may be carried over to these more public precincts. Deianakes, realizing this as well, brought himself under control and faced the Olympian Polyneikes with an expression of wry amusement. My wish for you, Callistus, is that you survive as many battles in the flesh as you have already fought in your imagination. Perhaps then you will acquire the humility of a man and bear yourself no longer as the demigod you presume yourself to be. Spare your concern for me, Deianakes, and save it for your boyfriend. He has greater need of it. That hour had arrived when the messes along the Amyclean way released their men, those over 30, to depart for their homes and wives, and the younger men of the first 5 age classes to retire under arms to the porticos of the public buildings, there to stand the night watches over the city or curl in their cloaks for sleep. Deianakes took these last moments to speak apart with Alexandros. The man placed an arm about the boy's shoulder. They moved slowly together beneath the unlit oaks. You know, Deianakes said, that Polyneikes would give his life for you in battle. If you fell wounded, his shield would preserve you. His spear would bring you safely back. And if death's blow did find you, he would swim without hesitation into the manslaughter and spend his last breath to retrieve your body and keep the enemy from stripping your armor. His words may be cruel, Alexandros. But you have seen war now, and you know it is 100 times crueler. Tonight was a lark, it was practice. Prepare your mind to endure its like again and again, until it is nothing to you, until you can laugh in Polyneikes' face, and return his insults with a carefree heart. Remember that boys of Lacedaemon have endured these harrowings for hundreds of years. We spend tears now that we may conserve blood later. Polyneikes was not seeking to harm you tonight. He was trying to teach that discipline of mind which will block out fear when the trumpets sound and the battle pipers mark the beat. Remember what I told you about the house with many rooms. There are rooms we must not enter. Anger, fear, any passion which leads the mind toward that possession which undoes men in war. Habit will be your champion. When you train the mind to think one way and one way only, when you refuse to allow it to think in another, that will produce great strength in battle. They stopped beneath an oak and sat. Did I ever tell you about the goose we had on my father's Kleros. This bird had formed a habit, God knows why, of pecking 3 times at a certain patch of turf before she waddled into the water with her brothers and sisters. When I was a boy, I used to marvel at this. The goose did it every time. It was compelled to. One day I got it into my head to prevent her. Just to see what she would do, I took up a station on that patch of superstitious turf. I was no more than 4 or 5 years old at the time, and refused to let that goose come near it. She became frantic. She rushed at me and beat me with her wings, pecking me bloody. I fled like a rat. At once the goose recovered composure. She pecked her little spot of turf 3 times, and slid into the water, contented as could be. The older peers were departing now for their homes. The younger men and boys returning to their stations. Habit is a mighty ally, my young friend. The habit of fear and anger, or the habit of self-composure and courage. He rapped the boy warmly upon the shoulder. They both stood. Go now, get some sleep. I promise you, before you see battle again, we'll arm you with all the handiest habits. Chapter 13. When the youths began dispersing to their stations, Dianeces, with his squire, Suicide, moved out to the road, joining a company of other officers assembling to proceed to the ecclesia, where they were to assist in the organization of the coming funeral games. A Helot boy approached Dianeces there before the mess, dashing up with a message. I was on the point of departing with Alexandros for the open porches around the Square of Freedom to take up my berth for the night, when a sharp whistle summoned me. To my astonishment, it was Dianeces. I crossed to him swiftly, presenting myself respectfully upon his left, his shield side. "Are you acquainted with the location of my house?" he asked. These were the first words he had ever addressed directly to me. I replied that I did. "Go there now. This boy will lead you." Dianeces said nothing more, but turned and departed at once with the body of officers toward the assembly. I had no idea what was required of me. I asked the boy if perhaps there was some mistake. Was he sure it was I who was required? It's you, all right, and we'd better make the pebbles fly. The townhouse of Dianeces' family, in contradistinction to the farmstead their Helot families worked 3 miles south along the Eurotas, stood 2 lanes off the Eventide road on the west end of the village of Pitana. It was not conjoined to other dwellings, as many in that quarter were, but isolated at the edge of a grove beneath ancient oaks and olives. It had itself been a farmhouse at some point in the past, and possessed yet the unadorned utilitarian charm of a country kleros. The house itself was unassuming in the extreme, barely larger than a cottage, less prepossessing even than the house of my own father in Asticus, though its courtyard and grounds, nestled within a grove of myrtle and hyacinth, arose like a haven of refuge and charm. One arrived upon the site at the terminus of a series of flower-girt lanes, each seeming to draw one deeper into a space of serenity and seclusion. Passing, as one went, the dappled clusters of other peers' cottages, their hearths aglow in the evening chill, with the peal of children's laughter and the happy yapping of their hounds spilling over the founded walls. The site itself and its bowered environs could not have appeared farther removed from the precincts of training and of war, nor offered more contrast and comfort to those repairing from them. Dianeces' eldest daughter, Illyria, who was 11 at the time, let me in the gate. I perceived low white walls surrounding an immaculately swept courtyard of plain tile brick decorated with flowers in earthen pots upon the sill. Jasmine bloomed along the unvarnished beams of an axe-hewn pergola. Wisteria and oleander nestled trim upon the face. A stonework watercourse, no wider than a handbreadth, gurgled along the northern wall. A servant girl, whom I did not recognize, waited beside a plaited wicker garden seat in the shadows. I was directed to a stone bowl and told to rinse my hands and feet. Several clean linen cloths hung upon a bar. I dried myself and rehung them scrupulously. My heart was hammering, though for the life of me I could not have said why. The maiden Illyria ushered me inside to the hearth hall, the solitary room other than Dionyces' and his wife Arete's bedchamber, of which the house was comprised. All four of Dionyces' daughters were present, including a slumbering toddler and a newborn. The second eldest, Alexa, now being joined by her sister, both of whom sat to the side and proceeded to card wool as if it were the normal activity for the middle of the night. These maidens were presided over by the lady Arete, who sat with the infant at her breast upon a low, uncushioned stool adjacent the hearth. I discerned at once, however, that it was not Dionyces' lady upon whom I was to attend. Instead, at her side, and more toward the meridian of the room, sat the lady Paralia, Alexandros's mother, the wife of the polemarch Olympius. This mistress began, without ceremony, to interrogate me on the harrowing her son had received not half an hour earlier in the mess. That she knew of this event at all, and so immediately, was surprise enough. Something in her eyes warned me I must choose my words with care. The lady Paralia declared that she was keenly cognizant of and held in profoundest respect the proscription against revealing any exchange spoken within the precincts of a peer's mess. Nonetheless, I might, without violating the sanctity of the law, yet vouchsafe to her, a mother understandably concerned about her son's welfare and future, some indication, if not of the precise words and actions of the aforesaid event, then perhaps some portion of its tone and flavor. She inquired by way of motivation, in the identical understated tone with which the peers of the mess had interrogated Alexandros, who it was who governed the city. The kings and the ephors, I replied at once, and of course the laws. The lady smiled and glanced, just for a moment, toward the mistress Arete. Yes, she said, surely this must be so. This was her way of letting me know that the women ran the show, and that if I didn't want to find myself permanently back in the farmer's shitfields, I'd better start coughing up a satisfactory dose of information. Within 10 minutes, she had gotten everything there was to get. I sang like a bird. She wished, the lady Paralia began, to know everything her son had done in the hours after he had defied her wishes in the Grove of the Twins, and set off to follow the army to Antirion. She grilled me as if I were a spy. The lady Arete did not interrupt. Her eldest daughters never lifted their eyes toward me nor toward the lady Paralia, yet they remained in their modest silence riveted to every word. This was how they learned. The lesson today was how to grill a boy in service, how a lady did it, what tone she took, what questions she asked, when her voice rose with a hint of threat, and when it lowered to assume a more confidential, candor-evoking tone. What rations had Alexandros and I taken? What arms? When our food ran out, how had we acquired more? Did we encounter strangers along the way? How did her son comport himself? How did the strangers respond? Did they show him respect worthy of a Spartan? Did her son's demeanor command it? The lady assimilated my responses, revealing nothing herself, though it was plain at certain junctures that she disapproved of her son's conduct. Only once did she permit actual anger to invest her tone, that when I acknowledged under compulsion that Alexandros had not secured the name of the boat captain who had ferried and betrayed us. The lady's voice shook. What was wrong with the boy? What had he learned all these years at his father's table and in the common mess? Didn't he see that this reptile, this fisher captain, must be punished, executed if necessary, to teach these scoundrels the price of playing perfidy with the son of a peer of Lacedaemon? Or if prudence dictated that he, this boatman, could be exploited to advantage? If war with the Persian came, This blackguard, turned informer, could prove an invaluable source of intelligence for the army. Even if he attempted through falsehood to play the traitor, this could be discerned and valuable knowledge acquired. Why didn't my son find out his name?
Your servant does not know, lady. Perhaps your son did, and his servant was unaware of it.
Call yourself I, Paralias scolded me sharply. You're not a slave. Don't talk like one.
Yes, lady.
The boy needs something to wet his throat, mother. This from the maiden Illyria, with a giggle. Look at him. If his face gets any redder, he'll burst like a tomato.
The grilling went on for another hour. Adding to the discomfort I felt on this hot seat was the effect of the Lady Paralia's physical appearance, which bore an uncanny resemblance to that of her son. Like him, the lady was beautiful, and like him, her beauty took the unadorned, underplayed, Spartan form. The wives and maidens of my native Asticus, and those of every other city in Hellas, routinely employ cosmetics and facial paint to enhance their comeliness. These ladies are keenly aware of the effect the artificial sheen of their curls or the pink of their lips produces upon any male within range of their charms. None of this entered into the scheme of the Lady Paralia, nor Arete either. Her peplos robe was split up the side in the Spartan style, revealing her bare leg to the thigh. This, in any other city, would have been lewd to the point of scandalous. Yet here in Lacedaemon it was unremarkable in the extreme. This is a leg. We women possess them just like you men. For Spartan males to leer at or ogle a lady in this dress would have been unthinkable. They had beheld their mothers and sisters and daughters naked since they were old enough to open their eyes, both in the girls' and women's athletic training and in the festivals, and the other women's processions. Still, these ladies, both of them, were not unaware of their personal magnetism and the effect it produced, even upon a boy in service drawn up before them. After all, wasn't Helen herself a Spartan? The wife of Menelaus, she whom Paris had carried off to Troy, the cause of endless suffering among Trojans and Greeks, and for whose peerless beauty's sake so many brave Achaeans lost their lives in Troy, far from their native country. Spartan women surpass for beauty all others in Hellas, and not the least of their charms is that they make so little play upon it. Aphrodite is not their goddess, but Artemis Huntress. Look at the loveliness of our hair, their bearing seems to say, which reflects the lamplight not by the artifice of the cosmetician's art, but by the sheen of health and the luster of virtue. Look in our eyes, which embrace a man's, neither lowering in contrived modesty, nor fluttering behind dyed lashes like Corinthian whores. Our legs we groom not in the boudoir with wax and myrtle, but under the sun in the race, and upon the ring. They were dams, these ladies, wives and mothers whose primary calling was to produce boys who would grow to be warriors and heroes, defenders of the city. Spartan women were brood mares, the pampered damsels of other cities might scoff. But if they were mares, they were racers, Olympic champions. The athletic glow and vigor which the gynaecagoge, the women's training discipline, produced in them was powerful stuff, and they knew it. Standing before these women now, my thoughts, despite all efforts, were wrung back into the past, to Diomache and to my mother. I saw in memory my cousin's bare legs flashing strong and well-made when we raced after some hare or doe with our dogs sprinting ahead up some rock-strewn slope. I saw the smooth, glowing flesh of her arm when she drew the bow, her eyes that shrank before nothing, and the flush of youth and freedom that suffused the skin of her face when she smiled. I saw again my mother, who was only 26 at her death, and whose memory to my eyes was of surpassing gentleness and nobility. These thoughts were like a room in the house of the mind that Dionyces spoke of, a room I had sworn since the three-cornered way never to permit myself to enter.
But now, finding myself here in this real room of this real house, before these womanly rustles and scents, the feminine auroras of these wives and mothers and daughters and sisters, six of them, so much female presence concentrated in so close a space, I was driven back in mind against my will. It took all my self-composure to conceal the effect of these memories and to answer the lady's continuing questions in good order. At last it seemed the Inquisition was approaching its conclusion. "Answer now one final question. Speak with candor. If you lie, I will know. Does my son possess courage? Evaluate his Andrea, his manly virtue, as a youth who must soon take his place as a warrior." It took no brains to see I was treading the thinnest of ice. How could one answer a question like that? I straightened and addressed the lady directly. "There are 1,400 boys in the training platoons of the Agoge. Only one displayed the temerity to follow the army, and that in knowing defiance of his own mother's wishes, not to say full awareness of what punishment he must endure upon his return." The lady considered this. "It is a politic answer, but a good one. I accept it." She rose and thanked the Lady Ariti for arranging this interview and for providing for its confidentiality. I was told to wait outside in the courtyard. The Lady Paralia's maidservant stood there still, smirking. No doubt she had overheard every word and would blab it to all the Eurotas Valley by sunrise tomorrow. In a moment, the lady herself emerged, deigning neither to look at nor speak to me, and accompanied by her maid, strode off without torchlight down the dark lane. "Are you old enough to take wine?" The Lady Ariti addressed me directly, speaking from the doorway and motioning me back within the dwelling. All four daughters slept now. The lady herself prepared a bowl for me, cut 6-1 as for a boy. I took a grateful swallow. Clearly this night of interviews was not over. The lady invited me to sit. She herself settled at the mistress's station beside the hearth. She placed a chunk of alfita barley bread on a plate before me and brought a relish of oil, cheese, and onion. "Be patient. This night among women will soon be over. You'll be back with the men with whom you clearly feel more comfortable." "I am at ease, lady, truly. It's a relief to be away from barrack life for an hour, even if it means dancing barefoot on the hot steel of the skillet." The lady smiled at this, but it was apparent that her mind was held by a more sober subject. She drew my eyes to hers. "Have you ever heard the name Ida Tychides?" I had. "He was a Spartiate slain in battle at Mantinea. I have seen his stone before the mess of winged Nike on the Amyclean Way." "What else do you know of this man?" the lady asked. I muttered something. "What else?" she insisted. "They say that Dekton, the helot boy called Rooster, is his bastard, by a Messenian mother who died giving birth." "And do you believe this?"
"I do, lady."
"Why?" I had stuck myself in a corner now. I could see the lady perceive it. "Is it because," she answered for me, "this boy, Rooster, hates the Spartans so much?" I was struck with dread that she knew this and for long moments could not find my tongue. "Have you noticed," the lady continued, in a voice that to my surprise displayed neither outrage nor anger, "that among slaves the meanest seem to bear their lot without excessive distress, while the noblest, those at the brink of freedom, chafe most bitterly? It's as if the more one in service feels himself worthy of honor, yet denied the means to achieve it, the more excruciating is the experience of subjection. This was Rooster in a nutshell.
I had never thought about it that way, but now that the lady had expressed it thus, I saw it was true.
Your friend Rooster talks too much, and what his tongue withholds, his demeanor announces only too plainly. She quoted, virtually verbatim, several seditious statements that Decton had spoken, in my hearing alone, I thought, on the march back from Antirion. I was speechless and could feel myself breaking into a sweat. The Lady Arete maintained her expression inscrutable. "Do you know what the Crypteia is?" she asked. I did. It is a secret society among the peers. No one knows who its members are, just that they are of the youngest and strongest, and they do their work at night.
And what work is that?
They make men disappear. Helots, I meant. Treasonous helots. Now answer this, and consider before you speak. The Lady Arete paused, as if to reinforce the importance of the question she was about to put. If you were a member of the Crypteia, and you knew what I have just told you about this helot, Rooster, that he had expressed sentiments treasonous to the city, and further declared his intention of taking action based upon them, what would you do? There could be only one answer. It would be my duty to kill him were I a member of the Crypteia. The lady absorbed this, her expression still betraying nothing. Now answer, if you were yourself a friend to this helot boy, Rooster, what would you do? I stammered something about exculpatory circumstances, that Rooster was a hothead, he often spoke without thinking, much of what he said was bluster, and everyone knew it. The lady turned toward the shadows. Is this boy lying? Yes, mother. I spun in startlement. Both older daughters were wide awake in their shared bed, glued to every word. I will answer the question for you, young man, the lady said, rescuing me from my predicament. I think you would do this. I think you would warn this boy, Rooster, to speak no more of such things within your hearing, and to take no action, however slight, or you yourself would dispatch him. I was now utterly discomfited. The lady smiled. You are a poor liar. It is not one of your gifts. I admire that. But you tread dangerous ground. Sparta may be the greatest city in Hellas, but it is still a small town. A mouse cannot sneeze without every cat saying God bless you. The servants in Hellas hear everything, and their tongues can be set awag for the price of a honey cake. I considered this. And will mine, I asked, be loosened for the cost of a bowl of wine? The boy disrespects you, mother. This from Alexa, who was 9. You must have him striped. To my relief, the Lady Arete regarded me in the lamplight with neither anger nor indignation, but calmly, studying me. A boy in your position should rightly stand in fear of the wife of a peer of my husband's stature. Tell me, why aren't you afraid of me? I hadn't realized until that moment that, in fact, I wasn't. I'm not sure, lady, perhaps because you remind me of someone. For several moments the lady did not speak, but continued regarding me with that same intense scrutiny. Tell me about her, she commanded. Who? Your mother. I flushed again. It made me squirm to think this lady divined the contents of my heart before I even spoke them. Go ahead, take some wine. You don't have to play tough in front of me. What the hell? I took it. It helped. I told the lady briefly of Asticus, of its sack, and of my mother and father's murder at the hands of the night-skulking warriors of Argos. The Argives have always been cowards, she observed, dismissing them with a snort of contempt that endeared her more than she realized to me. Clearly her long ears had learned my poor story already, yet she listened attentively, seeming to respond with empathy to hearing the tale from my own lips. "You have had an unhappy life, Zio," she said, speaking my name for the first time. To my surprise, this moved me profoundly. I had to fight not to let it show. For my part, I was summoning every ounce of self-composure I possessed to speak correctly in proper Greek worthy of a freeborn, and to hold myself with respect not only for her, but for my own country and my own line. "And why," the lady asked, "does a boy of no city display so much loyalty to this alien country of Lacedaemon, of which he is not and can never be a part?" I knew the answer, but could not judge how much I dared entrust to her. I responded obliquely, speaking briefly of Bruxius. "My tutor instructed me that a boy must have a city, or he cannot grow to be fully a man. Since I no longer possessed a city of my own, I felt free to choose any I liked." This was a novel point of view, but I could see the lady approved of it. "Why not, then, a polis of riches or opportunity? Thebes or Corinth or Athens? All that can come to you here is coarse bread and a striped back." I replied with a proverb that Bruxius had once quoted to Diomache and me, that other cities produce monuments and poetry. Sparta produces men. "And is this true?" the lady inquired. "In your most candid judgment, now that you have had opportunity to study our city, its worst as well as its best?" "It is, lady." To my surprise, these words seemed to move the lady profoundly. She averted her gaze, blinking several times. Her voice, when she summoned herself again to speak, was hoarse with affect. "What you have heard of the peer Idaticides is true. He was the father of your friend Rooster. He was something other as well. He was my brother." She could see me react with surprise. "You didn't know this?"
"No, lady."
She mastered the emotion, the grief I now saw that had threatened to discompose her.
"So, you see," she said, with a smile brought forth with effort, "that makes this young Rooster something of a nephew to me, and I an aunt to him."
I took more wine. The lady smiled.
"May I ask why the lady's family has not sponsored the boy Rooster and put him forward as a Mothox?"
"This is a special dispensation in Lacedaemon, a stepbrother category of youth, available to the lesser-born or bastard sons of Spartiate fathers primarily, who could, despite their mean birth, be sponsored and elevated, enrolled in the agoge. They would train alongside the sons of peers. They could even, if they showed sufficient merit and courage in battle, become citizens."
"I have asked your friend Rooster more than once," the lady answered. "He rebuffs me."
She could see the disbelief on my face.
"With respect," she added, "most courtly respect, but with finality."
She considered this for a moment. "There is another curiosity of mind which one may observe among slaves, particularly those who spring from a conquered people, as this boy Rooster does, being of a Messenian mother. Those men of pride will often identify with the meaner half of their line, out of spite, perhaps, or the wish not to seem to curry favor by seeking to ingratiate themselves on the better side."
This was indeed true of Rooster. He saw himself as Messenian, and fiercely so.
"I tell you this, my young friend, for your sake as well as my nephew's. The Cryptea knows. They have watched him since he was five. They watch you, too. You speak well, you have courage, you are resourceful. None of this goes unobserved and unremarked. And I will tell you something more. There is one among the Cryptea who is not unknown to you. This is the captain of knights, Polynices. He will not hesitate to slit a treasonous helot's throat, nor do I think that your friend Rooster, for all his strength and spirit, will outrun a champion of Olympia." The girls by now had all succumbed to slumber. The house itself and the darkness beyond its walls seemed at last entirely, eerily still. "War with the Persian is coming," the lady declared. "The city will need every man. Greece will need every man. But just as important, this war, which all agree will be the gravest in history, will afford a mighty